But one of my favorite hymns was one written by William Cowper, an 18th century British poet. It's entitled God Moves in a Mysterious Way. It's a pretty popular hymn. You probably know it too. My mom taught me that hymn as a kid, and I've grew up with it. Cowper himself, though, was a man that drew some curiosity about his life. His life was sort of a paradox, if you'd call it that. He was heavily talented, smart, bright mind. But on occasion, he suffered melancholy. He suffered from mental illness on occasion. He touched many lives, a lot of lives. But on occasion, when he suffered mental illness, on a few occasions, he tried to take his own life. A lot of paradoxes surrounded his life. He eventually came to Christ and was pastored by John Newton. They wrote hymns together. He wrote the hymn, God Moves in a Mysterious Way. That hymn itself, as they say, had as its inspiration one of his foiled suicide attempts. I won't go into the details because I'm more interested in the hymn itself than his life, though. We'll look at the hymn. But like many other hymns and great poetry that's been penned through the ages, God Moves in a Mysterious Way came out of a difficult place. I'll read you the first stanza. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. It's said that this first verse draws from the story of Christ in the storm, not the one where he was awoken and directly speaks to the storm and calms it, but the one from which he was on the shore praying and saw his disciples in danger out in the winds. And he comes not to speak and calm the storm, but to join them in the storm, walking it, keeping the storm under his feet, to restore their faith in the face of the stormy winds. He walked the storm with them, entering into that with them. He's got all these contrasts in this hymn, and it'll go down and down and down, contrasting human efforts with divine providence. But the book of Ruth, too, is a book of contrasts. And today, our reading from Ruth chapter 3 actually starts with the first five verses of chapter 3, then skips a whole bunch of verses, and then picks up again at the end of chapter 4, which is the end of the book, too. Somewhere towards the end of chapter 4, if you followed the reading, you'll see a chorus by the women of Bethlehem. They were praising God for providing redemption to Naomi. And in that chorus, they thanked God for providing a redeemer, a child, a baby for Naomi, and doing that through Ruth. But that's the second appearance of the women of Bethlehem as a group. They appear twice in the book of Ruth. The first appearance was at the lowest point of the book. This second appearance is going to be at the high point of the book, at the point of redemption. The women of Bethlehem, at the lowest point of the book of Ruth, received Ruth as she re-entered into her village empty. A little bit of background might help. If you've not read Ruth, actually, I'll encourage you to read it. Very, very great story. Very great story. There was famine in Bethlehem, land of bread. Contrasts. Famine. Elimelech took his wife, picked up his two sons, and took off. He eventually lands in Moab, settles there. You know, at the beginning, the writer didn't think there was need for all those details. Apparently, that wasn't his concern. He tells us the man died. His sons took wives. That was logical in that time and place. Family line needed to be continued. They didn't have time. Going back to Israel was still indefinite. They took Moabite wives. Again, the writer wasn't interested in what happened. Was there a war? Were they attacked? Were they ambushed? Bottom line, both guys died. And they were left with three widows in the story. Naomi was at a difficult place. because the onus was on her to do anything possible to redeem the family, the lineage of her husband. But the chances were slim. She lived in Moab, and she had Moabitess widows. Eventually, she heard the economy picked up in Israel. She was going to go back. She eventually goes back. One of the widows goes back to her country. The other one, Ruth, follows Naomi back to Israel. As Naomi entered the gates of Bethlehem, the women come to greet her. And they wonder, is that really Naomi? She was coming home alone. Well, not quite alone, but with a lady they didn't quite recognize. And then they were wondering, is it Naomi? And in the first meeting, at the lowest point of the book, it's Naomi's voice that we hear. And it's a cry of emptiness. She says, do not call me Naomi pleasant. That's the meaning. Do not call me pleasant. Rather, call me Mara, bitter, because God has dealt bitterly with me. I left full, but I return in emptiness. And that wasn't just about grain or money. It was about living with a husband and two sons, with a lineage, with being a part of a family and coming back to an empty home. Coming back and knowing that it's only a matter of time. After she's gone, her husband's compound was going to be desolate. Now, this may not mean so much to you as it meant for them as a 21st century Westerner, but in that time, that was big, serious business. It was so much of a serious business that in the law of Moses, accommodation was made to make sure that not even the death of a brother would stop a lineage. And Moses made those accommodations in the family codes and said, even if a brother dies, the brother is under obligation to continue the lineage of the other man so that no name be lost. But it's a family where everybody was gone. That's the problem. Unless you understand this problem, you probably won't understand the redemption chorus that we read about at the end. As these women sang this chorus, they make reference to the embodiment of this redemption, the newborn baby that's born. We'll come to that. But they also really give a place to the vehicle of this redemption, and that is Ruth. And so I'll just try to give 3 points today. 2 from this chorus, but the last one from the ending. I want to talk about God's redemptive acts. But my aim at this story is really, you know, this is happening at the culmination of Naomi's redemption. Let me get some water. This happens at the culmination of Naomi's redemption. We are a people walking through brokenness too. We are redeemed. We walk through brokenness. And we look forward to the culmination of our own redemption. As I look at this chorus, what I was interested in was what we can learn from God's redemptive acts in the life of Naomi that can help us in our own journey through the brokenness. When we come sometimes to that place where we think there's this disconnect between our name, between our identity, and the reality of our brokenness, how can we make it through trusting God? How did God do it for Naomi? Brought them to this point. So I first of all want to look at the vehicle of this redemption, and that was Ruth, as they said. They said, praise be God who has not left you without a redeemer this day. And then they go ahead to recount things about the redeemer that we'll come to, who was the boy. And then they go on to say, for your daughter-in-law, who is greater to you than 7 sons, gave birth to this redeemer, is the vehicle of this redeemer. And I would want to argue that God's redemptive means will sometimes defy our expectations. Ruth was the unlikeliest person to have done this. You know, when Ruth insisted on going with Naomi, and Naomi tried to discourage Ruth, on the surface, it appeared as if Naomi was just interested in Ruth's welfare. said, go back, I can't get you a husband at this point. I'm too old to have a baby. Even if I were to have a baby today, it's just a newborn baby. You can't wait. But it was more complicated than that. We're talking about a Moabitess, living Moab, to go with an aging mother-in-law. Two women in a world where male presence was almost indispensable in any family compound. To go home with her, there were no kids. They understood the risk that was involved. And Naomi was going to go home, and Ruth was going to take that chance, bid goodbye to her homeland, never to return there again, maybe, but definitely never to seek a future in Moab, but to go to live with a people who had skirmishes sometimes with Israel because she stuck to this family. But here's the catch, too. When Naomi was discouraging Ruth, Naomi was forgetting something. It was responsibility for Naomi to take Ruth home. But if this redemption was going to come, and if it was going to come legally, if Naomi's husband was already dead, and Naomi's two sons were already dead, and they had younger wives that could still have children, the only way this redemption could happen is that one of those women stayed in the family. It was a very unlikely door, but God left it open. Very unlikely, but God left it open. It seemed unlikely to Naomi, definitely didn't. And we'll come to the ending too. Even at that point, Naomi wasn't seeing it. But God's means will sometimes defy our expectations. The women say to Naomi basically something like this: how dare you say you came back empty when you came back with Ruth? He's worth more to you than seven sons. It was Ruth it was, when they land Israel, that will stay with Naomi when everybody else had gone home to their houses. Stay with Naomi, light the fire, stay by the firewood, tell stories, bring laughter on her face again. Ruth it will be that will get up early in the morning before dawn to go fetch food and come back home with Naomi when there was no male presence to grant them protection. Even the land, you will see if you read it. I really encourage you to read the story. Even that land wasn't tied to a male name at the time. Even the land itself needed redemption. They went to another land. It was Ruth that will be this to Naomi. But even that was little to the fact that it was Ruth eventually that God would use, a Moabitess, in the face of tribalistic Bethlehemites, to bring this about. You know, I need to say this for two reasons. First is, let's remember, when we walk through brokenness, redemption entails loss. For redemption to make sense as a word, there has to have been a state of loss, brokenness. And the brokenness that we feel is real. And sometimes the realities of our broken situations shout louder in our ears than we can hear God's providence. Second reason, we need to remember this, is that God doesn't always reverse our realities. He walks with them. There are a lot of things in Naomi's life that's not going to change. Naomi was right. She's not going to regain her youth and have children. Her husband is not going to come back alive. Her sons are not going to come back alive. When Ruth lands in Israel, the next of kin, the direct, exact next of kin, is not going to be head over heels about Ruth. A lot of realities that are not going to change. But the point is that God works with those realities to still bring about what he needs. And I don't know what you're going through. I know some of what I'm going through, some others I don't even understand. But whatever it is, I don't want to trivialize it. The point I'm making is not to say, you know, I don't buy this line in every case that you're trying to counsel someone and say, you know what, we don't know what God has in store. It's all well. Trust God. He's got something in store for you. It doesn't work all the time. The point I want to make is not that a bad situation is good because we don't know how it's going to work out. I don't want to trivialize it. The point I'm making, though, is that even though you're passing through that brokenness, you have a Redeemer, you have a God who knows how to take broken pieces, throw them all back into his mortar, and out of it, form a new story for you. And if you can find encouragement in that, please do. You have a Redeemer. They talk about Ruth. I wanna read you the third verse in the hymn, in Cooper's hymn. It says, "Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face." But God's redemptive means don't just defy our expectations. Looking at the embodiment of the redemption, the baby too, how the baby came about, I also think that God's redemptive purposes will sometimes transcend our strategies. The part that we read today finds Naomi strategizing a second time. But she was strategizing. You know, when we strategize, strategy basically is that you have to be able to, you visualize a goal, what you want to achieve, and you figure out how to achieve it. That's where Naomi was. By the way, what Naomi did was noble. What Naomi did was noble. She wanted to find a husband, security for Ruth. She was getting old. If you think life was hard enough for Naomi, as an Israelite, a Bethlehemite, in that place, an aging widow, it was going to be worse for Ruth when Naomi was gone. It was unthinkable what it would look like. Nobody had been talking to Ruth. She'd just been working, but time was also going, and Naomi said, you know, I can't just keep thinking about myself. I've got to find you security. And then she works out this detailed plan. We already read it, so let's not go back through it. But the point Naomi was trying to make through that plan was this. Change your clothes and all that. All of that plan was supposed to communicate to Boaz, one, that Ruth was done with the mourning period for her husband and was ready to enter into life, and that Ruth, now that she's ready to re-enter into social life, is interested in Boaz as a close relative of her late husband. Boaz catches up on this, but there's another catch with this. If this strategy had worked out exactly as Naomi planned it, Boaz will be married to Ruth if it worked out. Ruth would have security, but the family line of Elimelech can't be legally redeemed. And the ultimate purpose of this story, of God in this story as we read it, is the redemption of the family line of Elimelech. While God did not defy the strategy, God's purposes transcended them. And you'll read all over Ruth how Boaz is portrayed as a really good man, righteous man, considerate, compassionate. And he pushes back on what was an opportunity to acquire a wife, pushes back on it, and rather seeks to pursue the legal means on behalf of Elimelech's family. Long story short, they go through all this transaction. It's good to read this because definitely the writer of Ruth, himself or herself, or whoever they were, if they were a team, the writers of Ruth definitely wanted us to understand that this child that was born legally into the family line of Elimelech. He was a redemption child. And that legal means went into great details about it. The first guy that legally should have done this refused to do it. They went into all the legal transactions, and Boaz acquires Ruth, acquires the land. They give birth to a child who will be called Obed eventually. But The chorus of praise that we read here isn't really celebrating Ruth's son, technically. It was celebrating Naomi's son. That came about because God's ultimate purposes transcended Naomi's strategies. You know, I worked somewhere in my early days in the United States a while back, traffic analyst. My job was basically to make sure that the company's shipments got from point A to point B. I got a call one day at my desk from someone in the sales department. He says, I've got this customer. And you know salespeople, when they want to get you into a corner, they start by frightening you when you work in the same organization. He said, he's a $10 million customer. And then he said, they have an order. They've got two locations. It's a full truckload. They want to discharge part of it at the first location, then deliver the rest at the second location. Now, the customer's request is this. They've got an equipment in their company. They want to transfer from location A to location B, and we're already delivering to them, and we'll have that space in the truck. So they want us to, it's a free truck we have already, put their equipment in that truck after we deliver at the first location, and then they will deliver the rest at the second location along with their equipment. And my response was, you know, sure, I don't know, that wouldn't be a problem at all, but you know what, let me just run it by my manager. So we hung up. I walked over to my manager, and I tell him the story. Tell him, so I'm ready to call the carrier, and let's arrange this. My manager asked me, so did you ask him how much that equipment was worth? I said, no, I didn't. I said, did you ask him what sort of packaging that was? Was it liquid? Was it bulk? I said, no, I didn't think to do that. And he asked me a few questions I should have asked. I didn't ask. I was early in the job, by the way. And, you know, I didn't ask it at all. Then he coached me on it. The thing was that I had it all laid out in my head in my short view. But because as our manager, before him was not just my department and team. Before him also was the claims department that he deals with every day. And the audit department that he deals with every day. And he said, what if something happens? Something happens. Nobody's fault, but something just happens to that truck. You know, you need to figure out who takes liability for their own equipment. So I said, oh, yeah, I didn't think about that. you know, if it is true, if the premise is true, that God is infinite, and if the second premise is true, that we are finite, it will be very, very absurd that our strategies will match his 100% of the time. It will be absurd that that would be the case. Let me read you the second stanza of Cooper's hymn. Deep in unfathomable minds of never failing scale, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. The ending of this passage talks about Obed being the father of Jesse and Jesse being the father of David. God's redemptive means will sometimes defy our expectations, and God's redemptive purposes will sometimes transcend our strategies. God's redemptive story will always go beyond us. You know, you start out this story and you think at the beginning of Ruth, and you think, oh, this is the story of Elimelech. And then you're scarcely into the story and say, oh, Elimelech is gone. This is the story of Naomi. Probably Ruth. But you come to the ending, and there's something about the ending of Ruth. There's another paragraph after this, by the way, but there's something about the ending of Ruth that begs the question, who really was this story about in the first place? This is the beginnings of the story of a lineage that would eventually peek into a promise for the Davidic line. And so what we hear in this story is about how the lineage of the Messiah himself almost became extinct. And the Messiah carries in his incarnation, in his body, in his own family story, the risk of extinction. We can't have a better high priest. We can't. And this may not be personal to you, but it was personal to me. I think I also found there that somewhere in the Messiah's lineage, there was biracial marriage. You may call me foolish, but it was good. I can't have a better high priest. I can appeal to him when cross-cultural arguments rise up. But I can appeal to his priesthood. And he comes to our aid, too. He redeems us. But God's redemption story goes beyond us. It doesn't stop with us. And I think that is partly why also in his strategies, in God's strategies, in God's sovereignty, he looks beyond us and just collects us and puts us as parts of an ongoing story. It will extend beyond us. But I don't say that to discourage you. I say that actually to comfort you. This is bigger than us. And something tells me that when we cross the shores of this life and cross over on the other side, we will look back at what Christ has redeemed us from and we will fall down and worship God. Because the race of humanity, the human race, was going to suffer eternal death, extinction from the presence of God. But we had a redeemer through this lineage. A smaller story of redemption now blossomed into a lineage that will bring into the world the bigger story of redemption. And just as Naomi gave way for the lineage of David, for the David to enter into it, so also this story gives way for the gospel. I wrestled with this a little bit yesterday. I came to the point where I had some application, practical application to offer, and I wrestled a lot with that. And you know what? I scratched it. You're going to have to forgive me. I don't have any list to give you today. What I bring you, though, is comfort. This story, it's nothing about what Naomi did. It's everything about what God did in spite of Naomi. It's about God's ability to be trusted to redeem a family, even when we pursue our transient dreams, our transient goals. In spite of that, God still uses our mundane strategies, our limited expectations, pulls that, works with our reality. Whether he reverses them or not, he is a specialist at taking realities that are broken and making new stories. He does it so well that you're almost tempted to thank him for the brokenness in the first place. I bring you encouragement, not a list of things to do. He's your redeemer. I bring you comfort if you're passing through things and you're wondering, my name doesn't quite represent the situation I'm in. Don't call me Naomi. If you think the identity you claim on the outside is so contrary to what you're going through, I bring you comfort. And I can only say, please keep going. I want to end with a story. It's a fable. It's myth. I heard it a long time. I think it's got some different versions. But in that story, there was a king in his kingdom. His kingdom came under attack. As the invaders came in and closed up on his palace, he he realized that they were going to take over his palace. But what ties the king to the throne is a ring, the ring in his hand, meaning that whoever was going to get onto that throne would have to have the ring. That's what is essential to actually be king and recognized. So as he saw that his palace was going to be taken over, he rushed through the window, took off the king, the royal ring, sorry, and threw it through the window into the well in his backyard. They caught him, took him to the cell. But they couldn't kill him because they needed the ring anyway. He had a wife and a son. His captors wanted to figure out where the ring was. He wouldn't tell them. So each time his wife and his son came to visit him, they stood at hearing distance. And time was running out. The kingdom wanted a king. The elders had met, and there was a declaration, whoever finds the ring, get on the throne. We have to have a king by such a date. The king needed his son to know where the ring was, but he didn't know how to say it. So one of those days, his son visited him in the cell, and he said to him, you know, son, I had an idea sometime. I couldn't do it. I wonder if you can do that for me. Son said, what's that? I'll do it. He said, take a basket, take it to the front of the house, and keep fetching water from the well until you fill the basket. The son said, that doesn't make sense. Eventually, he got home, and he ran to the backyard, got the first pail of water, filled the basket, came back. All the water was gone, and he said, it doesn't make sense. And the mom said, you know what? I never knew your dad to waste a word. Keep fetching, keep filling. I don't know why myself, but I trust him. He ran back, and he came back, said, I told you, this doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. We all had this figured out. I had the place paid for, and I thought we were going to move as a church. It doesn't make sense. It all fell through. Keep fetching. Keep filling. It doesn't make sense. I got into this relationship thinking it will work out. It's all gone sour. It's all gone bad. I'm in heartbreak. And by the way, the only community I knew, I can't quite fit in anymore. People go through heartbreaks. But I tell you, at the end of the day, when you see the glittering ring by some dark corner of the well, it will all come together. I'll end, finally, with the two final verses of Cooper's hymn. His purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. Told you about the contrasts in this hymn. Blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his work in vain. God is his own interpreter, and he will make it plain. Amen.